Support for IPR comes from Corridor Vein Center and Corridor Aesthetics, treatment for varicose veins and spider veins, also providing facial rejuvenation services and treatment for moderate to severe acne. More at Corridor Vein and CorridorAesthetics.com.
It's River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, chemical threats to our air and to our water. We discuss new EPA regulations to curb cancer-causing air pollution. Later, new regulations to remove so-called forever chemicals from drinking water. But let's start with improving our air quality. More than 200 chemical plants across the country will now be required to curb the toxic pollutants they release into the air. This under a new regulation announced a few days ago by the Biden administration. The regulation is aimed at reducing the risk of cancer for people living near industrial sites. This is the first time in nearly two decades that the government has tightened limits on pollution from chemical plants. Later this half hour, the big picture on this significant step to improve air quality from University of Iowa environmental health scientist Peter Thorne. But first, a conversation I had yesterday with Chicago Tribune investigative reporter Michael Hawthorne. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
You have reported going back several years on a cluster of cancer cases involving a plant in West Suburban Willowbrook. Start by telling us what this plant made, because it's no longer there, I understand, and the chemicals involved. What was it doing?
Sure. So Sterigenics is the name of the company. It owns several of these facilities around the country, and it uses a gas called ethylene oxide. Ethylene oxide is a very potent germ killer. It's also volatile, and it's also very toxic. And so it's effective at killing germs on medical equipment, say, or in spices, which is what this plant did by basically shoving pallets of medical equipment into a vacuum chamber, pumping it into this ethylene oxide gas, pumping the gas back out, and then, you know, bringing the goods out, letting them off gas for some period of time, and then distributing them to hospitals and clinics. The thing of it is, this chemical, the Environmental Protection Agency has known for a very long time that this chemical causes cancer. And in part of my reporting during recent years, the industry has known this too. But it remained a fairly obscure industry until 2018, when the US EPA drafted or released, without really any notice, what they call a semi-regular assessment of parts of the country that face unacceptable risks from toxic air pollution. And compared to the previous version of this semi-regular report, ethylene oxide had been declared far more dangerous than previously thought. And so suddenly, because of this new data, because of the new scientific understanding, well, actually it wasn't new because it just took a while to make it official, many communities around the country, including in the Willowbrook area, also in North Suburban Waukegan, here on the north shore of Lake Michigan, all of a sudden these communities were found to have very high cancer risks. And that triggered a whole slew of regulation, study, industry pushback that led to these regulations that the Biden administration just finalized specifically for these commercial sterilizers. But as you mentioned in the introduction, also for the larger chemical plants that manufacture ethylene oxide.
Okay, let's go back a little bit in the timeline, Michael, here, because I want to see how the narrative developed here between these dangerous levels of, in this case, ethylene oxide gas. I assume when they're off-gassing, they're getting rid of the gas that was used to sterilize. It has to go somewhere. So this was going into the community to in some degree and affecting people. Yeah. That was studied?
So at one point, they were allowed, this industry was allowed to basically emit this chemical into the air with virtually no limits. And eventually some regulations were enacted. They were weakened at the behest of industry. But what ended up happening was they had to put some pollution control equipment to essentially scrub out the ethylene oxide vented out of these chambers. But based on what they learned about the toxicity of ethylene oxide, even that pollution control equipment that was required under earlier versions of these regulations wasn't enough to protect surrounding communities. And so what the EPA ended up finding in Willowbrook and then essentially extrapolating to other communities around the country was, number one, that the estimated cancer risks were even higher than what the EPA had modeled nationally. And then also that despite the pollution control equipment and even efforts that Sterigenix took in Willowbrook to reduce its pollution to down to 1%, that was still driving up the cancer risk, not only in the Willowbrook area, but according to the EPA, as far as 25 miles away, which in that radius would include a good part of the Chicago region. And eventually, Governor J.B. Pritzker took unusual action, not unprecedented, but rare action, and shut this company down, shut this plant in Willowbrook down. And they went back and forth with the federal government and with state government. And in the end, Sterigenix, all kinds of bipartisan pressure. The area where this facility was located is in a county, a suburban county of Chicago that once was the bedrock of Republican power in Illinois, is now gone increasingly towards the Democratic Party. And so voters really took note of this problem, of this risk. And among other things, in 2018, the then governor, Republican governor, Bruce Rauner, was running for re-election. I found that he was a part owner. His hedge fund or private equity firm was a part owner of this Sterigenix company. That became a huge issue in his race against Pritzker, who ended up beating him, and also a longtime Republican congressman in that part of the world, in the leadership of the Republican Party in the U.S. House of Representatives. He also lost his re-election bid.
Michael, talk a little bit more. You talk about the risk of cancer being high. Talk about the people, how the people there have been affected in these communities where the risk is high. Have you spoken with families, with people who have cancer that can be directly tied to this Willowbrook plant?
Well, in almost all cases, it doesn't matter whether it's ethylene oxide or any other form of pollution, it can be really difficult for scientists, epidemiologists to tie cancers to a specific source. But in this case, the EPA did conclude that it increased the risk, the lifetime risk. But you had people living in the community nearby, across the highway. This facility, the Sterigenix facility in Willowbrook, was behind a Target store, but on the other side of the road was a residential subdivision. And one woman that I interviewed had suffered and survived breast cancer. She ended up suing Sterigenix, and last year, in the early part of last year, she won the largest jury verdict for an individual in Cook County. That's the county that includes Chicago, in Cook County history. And the company Sterigenix later settled many of these other claims from people in the communities. And they've faced litigation in other parts of the country, California, suburban Atlanta. And it ultimately led the Biden administration to follow through on promises that were made during the Trump administration, but then were walked back due to industry pressure. So now we have a situation where the remaining commercial sterilizers, including the others that are owned by Sterigenix, are going to have to do essentially what they were planning to do in Willowbrook, and even more than that. And eventually, I think what they're going to be trying to do is using regulations to leverage this industry to significantly reduce ethylene oxide, and then also reduce their use of the gas, because it's essentially unsafe at any level.
How has Sterigenix responded to all this, this saga over the years? Have they, for instance, admitted they knew of the danger? Is it been shown that they knew they should be installing pollution control equipment?
Well, in the first case, you know, the jury verdicts that I and the settlements that I just mentioned, those included kind of the standard industry part of the deal that allows Sterigenics to pay out these settlements without accepting any responsibility for disease and other damages caused to individuals. So there's that. But when the state of Illinois was considering its own legislation to first outlaw the use of ethylene oxide altogether, but then, you know, initially after negotiations, moving to significantly restrict emissions into surrounding communities, what Sterigenics and its compadres in the sterilization industry did was hire industry scientists who had already been involved in a massive effort to get the federal government to back off a 2016 conclusion, an official conclusion by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, that ethylene oxide is far more dangerous, is a far more potent carcinogen than previously thought. Actually, that report by the EPA was, and I think your next guest, Dr. Thorne, can speak to this because he was on a scientific advisory board to the EPA that took a look at the EPA science, the science that really was in draft form in 2006. And so it took another decade for that to become official. And what industry and different administrations got the EPA to do is redo the science again and again. And so you had two panels of independent scientists, very unusual for any chemical, look at the EPA's findings about ethylene oxide, that it's more dangerous than previously thought, and agreeing essentially that what the EPA came up with. And, you know, that conclusion was based in part on a group of 15,000 workers who worked in the ethylene oxide industry, like in the sterilization industry specifically. But the big chemical companies like Dow and Shell and Huntsman, the ones that make this chemical, they saw this EPA conclusion as a threat to their bottom line. And all of their lobbying efforts and all of their efforts to muddle the science were brought to bear, not only here in Illinois, but also at the federal level.
We'll be back in just a moment with more of my conversation with Chicago Tribune investigative reporter Michael Hawthorne. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from IPR News.
Support for IPR comes from Corridor Vein Center and Corridor Aesthetics, treatment for varicose veins and spider veins, also providing facial rejuvenation services and treatment for moderate to severe acne. More at Corridor Vein and CorridorAesthetics.com. This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including Above and Beyond Cancer.
And we're back with more of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're looking at chemical threats to our air and water and new regulations. Under a regulation announced recently by the Biden administration, more than 200 chemical plants across the country will now be required to curb the toxic pollutants they release into the air. The regulation is aimed at reducing the risk of cancer for people living near industrial sites. Michael Hawthorne is a Chicago Tribune investigative reporter. He's been describing an increased cancer risk in the Chicago suburb of Willowbrook, linked to a chemical plant that he's been reporting on for several years. At this point in our conversation, recorded yesterday, I asked him what this new EPA regulation means.
Well, let's just go back in history. I mean, the EPA was poised to do this in essentially the year 2000, even before they concluded that this gas is more dangerous than previously thought. They already thought it was pretty dangerous. And the sterilization industry, according to records that I obtained from Freedom of Information Act requests, but also from a industry trade group that inexplicably, but, you know, great for journalism purposes, had all their private records actually publicly available. So it showed how they persuaded the federal government to back off more stringent regulations, because what had happened in the early 2000s, late 90s, is some of these sterilization plants blew up. They had explosions, and because this gas is highly volatile. And so they got the EPA and also the Occupational Health and Safety Administration, you know, to back off on workplace standards and standards for the environment. What ended up happening when they investigated these explosions, they were all due to operator error. If there was better training, these accidents likely would not happen. Now, flash forward to more recently, you know, the Biden EPA proposed a version of its regulations about a year ago. Those same arguments about the explosions were one of the arguments that the industry made to try to make it go away. And in the long run, those arguments were rejected, much like the arguments about the science were, the industry science.
Mm-hmm. Michael, what will you be watching as an investigative journalist on this going forward? Are there still for you big unanswered or difficult to answer questions?
I think it's more at this point maybe a legal political issue. These regulations are bound to be challenged and challenged in court. And in part, what they're going to do, what they've already been doing, is using some of this industry selective science to essentially create an alternative universe. And they want a court, anybody, they want the federal government, the courts, to require the EPA to use this alternative industry-friendly science. And they've even got the state of Texas, an agency in the state of Texas. Other records that I obtained showed that they were working in lockstep, the state agency, with the industry to come up with these conclusions that, just as Dr. Thorne could say, just don't stand up to scientific scrutiny for a bunch of reasons. Essentially, what they did was eliminated the entire possibility of a risk for breast cancer in women. That was one of the things that the study of all these sterilization workers showed. There was a lot of breast cancer. And so making that go away, also stripping away the extra safety level for children, that's the way that the industry gets to this kind of more friendly to them, friendly to their bottom line kind of conclusion. I think it'll be really interesting, given the tenor of our federal courts and the movement towards an anti-regulation agenda within the federal courts in specific districts and then at the Supreme Court. It will be interesting to see if science wins out in the end.
Mm-hmm. Michael, in your years of reporting on this, these cluster of cancer cases involving this plant in West Suburban Willowbrook, what has been the response from your readers there at the Chicago Tribune? What kind of interesting feedback have you received?
It was remarkable. I mean, you know, I used to be a political reporter, and you'd write a story at the State House or something like that, and you'd wonder if anybody had read it. Kind of thing, other than, say, like the lawmakers and the lobbyists at the State House. This was one of those stories, and I've been unfortunate to have several stories like this. The reaction was just so visceral. And Willowbrook is a very, it's a fairly well-to-do suburb. There are a lot of scientists from Argonne National Laboratory, nearby Argonne National Laboratory, who live in the community. They organized after my first story, they organized very quickly, and they kept the pressure on, and they kept bringing in people who had suffered various cancers linked to ethylene oxide exposure and showed their proximity to this Sterigenics facility. They also, because of their organizing, this group called Stop Sterigenics, you had politicians from both political parties just coming out of the woodwork, putting pressure on Sterigenics to either move or stop using ethylene oxide altogether. The activists and especially the community activists, they really took advantage of that and drove public debate for several years, frankly, and led to ultimately this federal action.
In the final few minutes we have together, Michael, the other Environmental Protection Agency news, the implementation of the first ever drinking water standards on six so-called PFAS chemicals. They join a list of nearly 100 contaminants like lead and copper, we already know, measured in our drinking water. Now, all states, I understand, must now screen for these additional six PFAS chemicals in public water systems. From your vantage point in Illinois, covering these sorts of stories, what is the significance of this EPA move?
It's huge. As several lawyers, have environmental attorneys and environmental health advocates have pointed out in recent days, this is perhaps one of the most significant regulations, water protection regulations, enacted by the federal government in 30 years. And it's crazy. I've actually been writing about these chemicals for almost 20 years, at first in the state of Ohio and in the Ohio River Valley, where the company DuPont made a version of these PFAS chemicals known as PFOA in the manufacturing of Teflon, anti-stick, anti-stain coatings. And they had polluted the water all around their plant. Well, as states like Iowa and Illinois, and California and New York, I mean, basically wherever scientists look for these chemicals in water or in soil or in people or in animals, they find these forever chemicals. And they're known as forever chemicals because they're made with bonds of fluorine and carbon, which are virtually indestructible. And I wrote 2 years ago about a plant on the Mississippi River north of the Quad Cities. And it's one of the main manufacturer of these chemicals, 3M, based in Minnesota. They had a plant, or have a plant, north of the Quad Cities where they made these chemicals. And it turned out that the state of Illinois knew more than two decades ago that this plant was dumping forever chemicals into the Mississippi River with no limit for decades. And it wasn't until just recently that the US EPA intervened and required 3M to start screening out these forever chemicals into what they dumped into the Mississippi River. But communities downstream, including the Quad Cities, and many on both sides of the Mississippi, have real problems with these chemicals in their water. Oddly enough, actually, the first one that was fixed is Comanche, Iowa, which is actually upstream from the 3M plant, which shows that water is not the only way that these chemicals travel. They also travel through the air. And the really disturbing, one of the really disturbing aspects of this story is that, even scientists are even finding these chemicals in polar bears in the Arctic, far away from any potential manufacturer. And so much like some other chemicals in the past that have since been banned, these chemicals are everywhere. They're in almost every human. Babies are born with them in their blood. And so turning off the tap is, what they say is probably going to be the first thing we're going to have to do. And these limits in drinking water, they're going to really be expensive. And 3M and DuPont have paid out billions of dollars in legal settlements and probably will face more legal action. The federal government is chipping in too, but you're going to have, think about all these small Iowa communities where the state has found these chemicals. How are they going to afford these, very expensive upgrades to their water treatment plants? Those questions still haven't been answered. We're moving in the right direction. We're just not moving fast enough.
Well, Michael Hawthorne, you've given us so much to think about, to consider, so much, I must say, to worry about. But if it's a step in the right direction, that's at least something. Thank you for your excellent investigative reporting and sharing some of it with us. Chicago Tribune investigative reporter Michael Hawthorne, thank you.
Thank you.
That conversation with Michael Hawthorne recorded yesterday. It's River to River from IPR News. Ben Kiefer live now for the rest of the hour as we continue to discuss these disturbing chemical threats to our air and water quality. If you've just joined us recently, the Biden administration announced new EPA regulations to curb cancer-causing air pollution, also new regulation to remove so-called forever chemicals from drinking water. Joining me now, live, environmental public health scientist Peter Thorne in our Iowa City studio. He is distinguished chair, professor as well at the University of Iowa College of Public Health, currently a member of the EPA Advisory Board, former chair of that board. Peter Thorne, welcome back to our program.
Well, thanks, Ben, and thanks for covering this important public health issue.
And we have you to thank for getting us in touch with Michael Hawthorne. I understand you've been a critical source for many of his reports, investigative reports there in Illinois. I want to remind our listeners that while we have Peter here for the next few minutes, your questions are invited about our air and drinking water quality, what we've been talking about, these EPA regulations, 1-866-780-9100, or email rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Peter, let's start with the air quality regulation here. Summarize what these regulations now require that wasn't required before.
Sure, Ben. Well, what Michael Hawthorne talked about, he was really focused on ethylene oxide, which is one of the chemicals that is covered under this new rule. The rule addresses more broadly toxic emissions from the what's called the synthetic organic chemicals industry. So this includes industries and companies like BP Amoco, Exxon, Mobil, Shell, DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, Goodyear, the companies that are in the petrochemicals, plastics, and rubber manufacturing. And so there's 207 chemical plants around the country that are covered by this, but it especially affects those in 51 in Louisiana, 80 in Texas. And these are areas that we commonly refer to as Cancer Alley because the people who live there carry an excess burden compared to the rest of the U.S. on cancers that are environmentally linked. And so this rule seeks to control emission of these very toxic, very reactive and volatile chemicals that are used in the manufacture of plastics and rubber products.
Now, I know air pollution affects us across the country wherever plants are located, but any of these plants specifically in Iowa, I know the threat is regardless of where you are in the U.S. But anything more specific to Iowa in these?
Yeah, I think in that sense, fortunately for us, there isn't a major petrochemical industry in Iowa. There's one facility on the list of 207 that is covered. It's in Manly, Iowa, but it's not one of the very large refinery chemical plant facilities that are covered under this rule.
Mm-hmm. Tell us more about the toxicity. And it's amazing when I hear Michael recount that, since this toxicity has been known for so long, why has it taken so long to put these regulations in place?
Well, let me start by saying that there's really six major chemicals that will be affected about this, but the most toxic are ethylene oxide, which your guest spoke about at length, and chloroprene. Ethylene oxide is, he mentioned, it's used in sterilizing medical equipment mm-hmm. and as a spice fumigant. It's also used to make ethylene glycol and polyurethane foam, which are very huge products in the U.S. And ethylene oxide is long been known to be a mutagen that binds to DNA and causes cancer of the breast, lymphoid cancers, which includes things like Hodgkin's lymphoma and lymphocytic leukemia, and also is associated with adverse reproductive outcomes. The other major one, chloroprene, is used in producing neoprene, which is a synthetic rubber product. And it is also a mutagen, and it's also known to cause cancer in animals and highly anticipated to do so in humans, being associated with lung, liver, and kidney and thyroid cancer. So to your question, why is it taking so long? I think it's interesting that Michael Hawthorne mentioned the 2016 evaluation that the Science Advisory Board did of an EPA risk assessment document. I chaired that review, and we looked at the data, and the data on occupational exposures to ethylene oxide in the U.S. in a sterilizing facility with female workers in Sweden went back decades and decades, and it was a very rich data set. Oftentimes with chemical risk assessment, we only have animal data or we have scant epidemiologic data. In this case, there was massive quantities of data, and we evaluated it, and it was very complicated coming up with what is actually the most protective level that is appropriate to apply based on this science. And so this was contested by industry. They they presented different studies that they thought our panel should be relying on for the risk assessment rather than the studies that we were relying on. And it was pretty clear that those studies they were bringing forward were weaker studies in terms of not having good exposure assessment, not good follow-up, having mixtures of exposures. And so our panel relied, and the EPA relied on the best science to make that decision. And it took a long time because there are thousands of studies to be evaluated, and it's a very important decision for the EPA to make. So they had to be very careful, and there was a lot of opportunity for feedback from industry at every step of the process.
Mm-hmm. And so the answer to why now, this particular time, 2024, is it simply took that long to provide the evidence and to put down the arguments that were put by industry to make it solid enough to go forward with these regulations?
I think that's a part of it. And, you know, I think we have to be mindful that the EPA leadership is our political appointees. So things change with administrative priorities.
Okay. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion with environmental public health scientist Peter Thorne of the University of Iowa. We invite you to join us with your questions about air and drinking water quality. We'll focus mostly on air quality and these new EPA regulations when we come back. It's River to River from IPR News.
This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including Above and Beyond Cancer.
We're back with more River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Recently, the Biden administration announcing new EPA regulations to curb cancer-causing air pollution, also new regulations to remove so-called forever chemicals from drinking water. We're joined this portion of the program by environmental public health scientist Peter Thorne, distinguished chair and professor at the University of Iowa College of Public Health, currently a member of the EPA Advisory Board. Join us with your questions, 1-866-780-9100, or email rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Let's keep on with the air topic here, Peter. With this new regulation, over 200 chemical plants across the country now required to curb toxic pollutants they release in the air. How much will be prevented from getting into the air we breathe, whether we're in states with these industrial plants or not?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the EPA has spent quite some time evaluating this. And they estimate that the rule will reduce emissions of about 100 toxic chemicals to the air of 13,400,000 pounds, which is just an astronomical amount when you consider the toxicity of these compounds. In addition to that, when you control these by plugging leaks, essentially, it reduces release of other volatile organic compounds, which are known to produce urban smog and ground-level ozone. And their estimate is that it will reduce those emissions by 23,000 tons. So these are really, and that's per year. So it's really very, very impactful legislation mm-hmm. and rulemaking.
Talk about the chemicals company's perspective here. How will they be affected? We've heard about their bottom line and so forth. Can they implement this easily, or will it take a great deal of work?
There's two sides to that. They can implement it. They know what to do. The technology exists. And basically, it means that they have to plug leaks. So if you imagine a chemical plant and a refinery, there's miles and miles of piping, storage tanks, valves. It's all under pressure. And these things leak. And they leak at the connections. They leak at the valves. And so what the manufacturers will have to do is they'll have to plug all these leaks, and there'll be some benefit to this because those things that are leaking to the environment are valuable commodities that they sell. So they'll gain some back from that aspect of it. But the estimate is it'll cost them about $150 million per year collectively to plug these leaks. And that's about 1% of annual sales.
Right. They have revenues in the hundreds of billions of dollars.
Right. So $150 million is nothing to sneeze at, but when you look at the total revenue of these companies, it's certainly well within what they can do. And so really plugging leaks is what it all comes down to. And these are routinely referred to as fugitive emissions. And so what they'll be doing, what the EPA will be doing to monitor this is they'll be monitoring these chemicals at the fence line to ensure that the companies are complying with the rule. Mm-hmm. And the other thing it will do is there have been in the past exemptions during periods of startup, shutdown, or malfunction, and those exemptions will go away. So mm-hmm. they won't, every time there's a high release, they won't be able to just say, oh, that was startup or that was a malfunction.
As you mentioned before, of course, the EPA has been highly politicized, especially in recent times. Could these regulations, it sounds like they're critical for our health for a lot of reasons, could they be rolled back depending on the powers that be elected in whatever offices?
Congress makes laws, and then it's up to the EPA to decide how to execute those through rulemaking and regulation. So, yes, they could be weakened, they could be rolled back. But, you know, my feeling is that these have been so long in the making, so well studied, that it's well overdue. And I think there's going to be a move to really comply with these very quickly.
And we heard in Michael Hawthorne's account of the Willowbrook suburban plant that really it was bipartisan pressure in that suburb of Chicago, continued pressure, I understand, and I don't know if you agree with that, that finally achieved the shutting down of that plant.
Well, that was, yes, and I think one thing to point out is, as he mentioned, that was a fairly affluent community of highly educated people who had political connection. Many of the communities we're talking about are low-income minority communities that really have, as I said earlier, borne the burden of these chemical exposures for a long time. So there's a strong environmental justice component to this particular regulation.
Mm-hmm. Has that been perhaps a problem in getting these regulations through because they don't tend to affect more affluent communities?
Many people would make that case. I would agree with that. And, you know, there aren't a lot of senators living next to these refineries. So I think that the fact that the Biden administration has really established environmental justice as a strong priority, and this is reflected in Administrator Michael Regan, EPA Administrator Michael Regan's major efforts, that's also a reason why this is coming forward at this time in such a strong manner.
Up to this point in the air quality discussion here, we've talked about impacts on humans. What other impacts does the release of these chemicals have on our environment aside from humans?
Well, these are mostly toxic to humans and animals. These chemicals are not particularly leading to deforestation or other aspects like that. So I think really the focus here is less on environmental quality, more on human health.
Mm-hmm. What can we expect now from these chemical companies in terms of their stance going forward after, you know, providing counter arguments against the science here, which now seems to be clear? What can we expect from the chemical companies, the big ones?
Well, I would really hope that they'll start plugging leaks and start redoing their equipment, and fence line monitoring will show whether they're in compliance or not, and they're going to have to make major steps. So hopefully their engineering people are working on this already. At the same time, there is always some pushback. The American Chemistry Council represents this industry and the American Petroleum Institute, two trade groups, and they've been, as Michael Hawthorne stated, have been trying to advance a different interpretation of the science, and this will be evaluated just like we always do, looking at the best available science.
Mm-hmm. Before we move on to PFAS, forever chemicals in drinking water, are there any other aspects of this you want the air quality regulation that are new that you want to make sure we know about?
Well, I alluded to this earlier that this will also substantially reduce volatile organic chemical release, which leads to ground-level ozone. Ground-level ozone, which is a major component of urban air pollution, really has an untold burden on asthma and other respiratory diseases, lung development in children. So this is sort of a side benefit of this, that when you control these things like ethylene oxide and chloroprene, you also reduce other VOCs that are coming out of these leaks, and that will have major benefits for urban air quality and children's environmental health.
Mm-hmm. If you've just joined us talking this portion of the program with environmental public health scientist Peter Thorne of the University of Iowa College of Public Health. Well, let's spend a few minutes talking about forever chemicals. Unfortunately, we've heard that phrase again and again in our news, and the Environmental Protection Agency implementing what I understand to be the first ever drinking water standards on six PFAS, as they are known, joining a list of other contaminants we know well, lead, copper, that all states have, up to this point, I understand, been screening in their public water system, so regardless of the community that you're in. So again, what is the significance of this new EPA standard on forever chemicals?
Sure. Well, there's a whole list of chemicals that have what are called MCLs, maximum contaminant limits, that purveyors of public drinking water have to measure and report to their consumers. And you mentioned some, but there's a lot of them: arsenic, nitrates, coliforms, bacteria, many different ones. And so this really adds PFAS chemicals to that list. And what's significant is that we're starting to call these forever chemicals, which is a relatively new term. In the past, we've used POPs, persistent organic pollutants, as the buzzword for these. But the forever chemicals, I think that's a good way of saying it, because they do stick around for a long, long time. And they do move through the food web such that they end up in people through drinking and through eating contaminated fish and other animals. So they're important. What's really striking about this, though, is that there's still quite a lot of uncertainty associated with just how dangerous these are. There's evidence there. Well, that. Let me come back to that point. And also, there's about 4,000 of these that are out there.
Wow.
Some say even 12,000, depending on how you count
them.
And
it's flowing through my bloodstream, your bloodstream. Everyone listening has these in their bloodstream.
Exactly. But we also have lead, and we also have PCBs, and we have a lot of phthalates and BPA. And so, you know, I mean, we live in the environment, and whatever's in the environment can be in us. And when it doesn't get rapidly metabolized or excreted, it stays within us and can cause adverse health effects. And so, you know, there's now some growing evidence that these can cause disruption of hormone cycling and endocrines. They can lead to perhaps cancers. They can cross the placenta and maybe have adverse birth outcomes associated with them. So, but there's a lot more to be known, and it's hard to know everything about 4,000 chemicals. So this is a first step. We've identified these six. We know that they have toxicity and they're in the environment. And if we control these, the hope is we're controlling many of that other 4,000 on the list just by proxy. The other thing that's remarkable is that the proposed maximum contaminant level for these is, for some, it's 4 parts per trillion, and for others, it's 10 parts per trillion. And a part per trillion is almost—
That's a huge dilution.
Fathomable to grasp. I mean, I've—
And even that dilution is a problem.
Well, this is the level that they've deemed as safe.
Oh, okay.
Right. So the implication being more than that is unsafe, right? But we don't know for sure at this point. So this is a first step. And I think over time, as there's more research done, we'll get a better understanding of what really is a safe level or not. But if I read that 4 parts per trillion is 4 seconds in 32,000 years.
Oh, that puts it in perspective.
Or 4 drops of water in 20 Olympic-sized swimming pools. Mm-hmm. So it's really a minuscule amount.
Okay, so unlike the air toxins we were talking about earlier under these new EPA regulations, here these forever chemicals, these PFAS, the jury is still more out. We need more science done. Do we have an idea how long it will take to come to a conclusion about the the impact they're having on our health, on wildlife health, on our world, on our environment.
Yeah. So in the last 5 years, in my service to the National Academy of Sciences and to the EPA Science Advisory Board, I've had countless briefings on PFAS compounds. There's been a tremendous amount of work being funded now by NIH to look at the hazardous nature of these compounds. There's large epidemiologic studies going on. So I think within the next several years, this emerging science will grow and we'll be able to perhaps have a higher level of confidence in what is a safe level, and these might change. But I applaud the EPA for doing something now and not waiting for the science to get more refined, because it's clear that these are in the environment, people are exposed, they have adverse health effects, and we need to really pay attention to making our drinking water safe. And Joe Biden's comment on this was every American deserves to be able to turn on their water tap or faucet and be able to drink clean water. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's behind this, is providing clean water for everyone.
Yeah, regardless of who's in the White House in the coming years, will that make a big difference on how these toxins, possible toxins in our environment, are pursued vigorously or less vigorously by the EPA, and rules carried out to rein in the possible and known problems?
You know, I've been working alongside and with the EPA for decades, and I've seen sort of the priorities come and go with each administration and each administrator of the EPA. But a lot of the science continues by the rank and file scientists within EPA who are just doing a tremendous job every day. And so they'll continue to do the research that we need. And when that research points in a direction that there's a significant hazard to the health of the populace, I'm confident that the EPA will be there to take the action needed to protect us.
Just to summarize in the final minute we have today, Peter Thorne, we should feel good about this step.
I think these
two steps, these EPA regulations having to do with air quality and water quality, you feel good about this, scientists investigating this do, and we should, as inhabitants of this community here in Iowa and of this planet, we should feel good about this step.
I think this is an interesting contrast. We have a set of compounds that are known human carcinogens. We have ample data from animal studies, in vitro studies, epi studies we've known for decades. And then we have an emerging chemicals of concern where we're just getting the data as fast as we can and learning more about it. So I think both issues are super important, and I'm really very happy to see them getting made into rulemaking that can protect the health of the public.
Mm-hmm. What do you have your eyes on in 30 seconds in the future in this regard? What will you be watching? Perhaps what will you be working on in your research?
Well, we will certainly be learning more about PFAS compounds. And as the epidemiology studies come, I'll be looking at those very closely. And I'm sure I'll be reviewing those as in my roles with EPA and National Academy to really understand what it means. But translating that into policy levels and figuring out the uncertainties, that's where the rubber meets the road. And I think that's where I get into it as a scientist.
Right. We can tell you are very passionate about this. Thank you, Peter Thorne, for raising our awareness about it so that we may be informed about this, the health that affects all of us and coming generations. Environmental public health scientist Peter Thorne, distinguished chair, professor at the University of Iowa College of Public Health. Always a delight to speak with you.
Thanks so much,
and
Ben.
We have some positive news here, so that's good.
Yeah. All right. Take care.
Take care. You too. River to River today, produced by Danny Gear, with help from Caitlin Troutman and Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on the program, it's a Politics Wednesday edition of our program. Analysis from political scientists Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University. We hope you'll join us too. I'm Ben Kiefer. Until then.